This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Two recent situations in Vermont communities have raised the issue of racism and bias in schools. The debate over changing the nickname of the South Burlington school mascot from Rebel to something else was very heated and derailed budget approval twice before voters finally approved a budget earlier this month. Then, though, on the same day as the vote in South Burlington, the high school had to close an athletic field because racist graffiti was spray-painted across it. In Milton this month, a student reported that she was called racist names, but then she herself was asked to stay home by school officials. Michaela Lee's mother, Maria Twitty, says it was a de facto suspension for her daughter, who should have been treated like a victim, not a troublemaker. In that situation, the Vermont chapter of Black Lives Matter has gotten involved, trying to talk with the school district about racism and what kind of change could be helpful. BLM organizer Ebony Neone says these conversations have been unsuccessful, and Black Lives Matter is calling for the resignation of Milton Superintendent Ann Bradshaw. Today on the program, we're going to talk about racism, bias, and Vermont schools. In a little while, we'll be hearing from the Secretary of the Agency of Education and from people who've been working in Vermont schools to train teachers and administrators. But first, we turn to Black Lives Matter Vermont founder Ebony Neone. Ebony, what a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
What do you think should have happened in the situation in Milton?
Well, I think what should have happened is that the superintendent would have stepped up and provided some leadership around the incidents and also restorative justice opportunities between the young student, the principal, and the police officer was not, you know, afforded to the student. So those things should have happened.
You're calling for the resignation of Superintendent Ann Bradshaw, who you describe as incompetent to address this type of situation. But this is not an isolated scenario where racial bias, overt racism, lack of awareness makes students of color feel less safe, less comfortable, less welcome, less able to learn in their schools. Can you talk a little bit about what you hear happening in Vermont schools?
Exactly. Well, some consistency across the state is students of color being called racial slurs. Mostly the majority black students, but there are other students of color, Asian, Latin, who are also being racially bullied and harassed. And what seems to be a trend is that the school administration is not equipped. School administrations are not equipped to handle such cases, and so they end up, rather than responding in a healthy way so that the victims are feel protected and safe, they end up focusing on the victim and a lot of times suspending the victim who express feelings of frustration.
What's the rationale for that? For suspending somebody who says, I'm a victim of racism or I'm being called racist names?
Well, believe it or not, many times the rationale for that is to say that the victim or the student of color is being aggressive or is being intimidated because they're expressing the fact that they're angry at what they're undergoing in school.
So it's this sense of you must have caused it or somehow you're contributing to this situation?
Exactly.
Ebony, in a school where there might only be a couple of students who identify as students of color or who are visible in the school as students of color or maybe even no students like that, how do you reinforce that this is still an issue that is in schools and that schools need to be aware of and be dealing with?
Definitely. Well, even if there were schools with absolutely no children of color, I believe that the atmosphere should be conducive to receiving students of color or educating the students, white students, about the world, which is a very diverse world. And we're just we're taking away from all students when we don't educate them on, you know, the rest of the world, the society that we live in, which is very diverse with many people of color.
So you actually think that there should be curriculum changes in all schools?
Yes. Well, right now we're working on school districts one at a time, and we've started with Chittenden School District, but really it is Vermont Public Schools' problem, and we're looking to eradicate racism from Vermont Public Schools. And some say that might be a large task, but really it isn't. It's just about people getting on board. It's about racial bias being addressed in schools. And we need to do this. We need to make sure that curricula across the board is diverse and is, and also not just diverse where they're talking about different people of color, but also celebrating the accomplishments, the achievements that many people of color have made towards the success of this country.
And when you say Chittenden, you mean in Chittenden County, not Chittenden the town?
Chittenden County. Yeah.
So, you know, and so part of it here is not just celebrating Black History Month, but,
exactly.
but having it be part of the curriculum. And
exactly.
in fact, you have sort of a three-pronged effort mm-hmm. that you're working on here, mm-hmm. and that's one of them. So changes mm-hmm. to the curriculum.
Yes.
So African-American history is just part of the curriculum and not sort of this standalone
yes,
thing.
Yes, interwoven.
Only, yeah.
Yes. It's in the math. It's in the science. It's in the history. It's in every – it's in literature. It's in every part of the curricula.
Okay, so that's sort of the third prong, and then you have others. Cultural competency training for
yes.
all school administrators and teachers. What does that look
yes.
like?
That looks like opportunity for restorative justice. That looks like including students, especially those who have been victimized by school systems, and kind of restoring trust between a student and administrators. It also looks like an ongoing opportunity where teachers can't just say, oh, we did that. We got our 2 credits for that. But it's like becomes a part of school culture and lifelong learning.
When you talk about restorative justice, can you mm-hmm. describe what that looks like? Because I think you know, that's familiar to some people, but not all. And, mm-hmm. and how does that look in a school scenario where you mm-hmm. have students and teachers coming together to try to address mm-hmm. what happened? Because it's not always a comfortable situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like taking away all the power structures that have been built around like school systems and allowing students to feel like they're on the same level as teachers and administrators, allowing the people who are involved to feel like they're moving together to achieve something together, opposed to top down. And so and restorative is saying also that, you know, I may have made some mistakes down the line, and I am sorry, and I am looking to you to tell me how I can can be better in future scenarios.
So we've talked about a couple of the things that you think need to happen in mm-hmm. Vermont schools. So training for school administrators and people who work in schools, mm-hmm. changes to the curriculum so mm-hmm. all students are learning about mm-hmm. multicultural history mm-hmm. and not just history. Mm-hmm. And then you also would like to see statewide policy on racial discrimination and disciplinary action when mm-hmm. there are incidents in schools. Mm-hmm. Do you have a prescription for what that kind of policy would look like?
Yes, part of that prescription would entail the Department of the Agency of Education to really step up and show some leadership around this and start to mend bridges that have been burned. We pride ourselves on being on local government and being able to have, you know, our schools be the same flavor as the towns. But there's some things that cause, you know, students across the board to benefit less from having kind of local government and the school system. So we do need to have some policies that are across the board in education, such as disciplinary policies where Black students are the discrepancy between black students and their white counterparts is alarming, whereas black students are being suspended and expelled from school at a much higher rate, a much higher effect than white students.
What kind of leadership do you see or would you like to see at the Agency of Education on these initiatives that you think need to be implemented across the state?
Well, I think the Agency of Education should start investigating schools with complaints of racial bias or racial bullying and harassment. Like, they should show leadership that this is totally 100% unacceptable. And I think there needs to be some backtracking, too. There's a lot of cases where students have, gone through school districts and not seen any justice on their end. There's, for example, one young girl who's 15, just turned 15, and she just finished her first year at BHS High School, and she was suspended six times.
We're talking today about how Vermont schools deal with racism and race, and we've been talking with Ebony Nioni about what might need to happen at a statewide level. And coming up in just a minute, we're going to talk with the Secretary of Education, Rebecca Holcomb, about that. Ebony Nioni is founder of Black Lives Matter Vermont, and I want to mention that the group is holding a community meeting tonight at 7 in Winooski to discuss findings in the Burlington School District, and another meeting for Milton community members is tomorrow. There are details at blacklivesmattervermont.com. Ebony Nioni, thank you very much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Today we're talking about how Vermont schools are addressing issues of racism, bias, and diversity. A couple of recent incidents have been unsettling for community members in Milton and South Burlington. But Ebony Nioni of Black Lives Matter just explained that these are not isolated incidents. So we're talking about what could or should happen across the board in Vermont schools to address race, racial issues, racism. Becca is calling in from Hartford. Hi, Becca. Go right ahead.
Hi. So I wanted to call in to talk about an experience we've been having in Hartford, Vermont. I serve on the select board in Hartford, and we had a fellow select board member of mine send out a racially charged email that, because of that, brought forward incredible stories from people of color in our town and in our community talking about discrimination that they've faced directly. And in response to that, the select board formed and is in the process of working with a racial inequality committee. And when we originally approached the school board about this idea, they voted against being a part of the racial inequality committee. And after multiple, I would say, lots of activism in the community and really people of color having a leadership role in this, the school board voted to actually become a part of the committee. So,
Becca, thanks for your call. Let's turn now to Rebecca Holcomb, Secretary of the Agency of Education. Secretary, it's nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What specifically is the AOE doing to address or provide guidance to those specific incidents we talked about in Milton and South Burlington and other schools who might be questioning how do we attack and address racism?
Well, first of all, you know well from previous conversations that the agency nor the superintendent can actually comment on these specific incidents publicly. But what I can do is speak generally about the agency and the work that we do. And I would like to start actually by backing up, because I think there's different levels on which we have to grapple with this issue. And I just want to commend Becca for saying that this is really a statewide issue. It is a statewide issue. And I want to thank Ebony Nioni for really putting this on the table, because this is really an opportunity for us to ask structurally how we are or are not supporting all of our children well. And I think it's pretty clear when you look at our data that we aren't actually providing support for all children in an equitable way. So before that, I want to also just untangle a little bit the difference between overt racism, which is one manifestation of this, and something that the agency's really been trying to grapple with, which is implicit bias.
And I want to get into those, but I do want to know, specifically, Are there things when schools call and say, I have a problem,
yes,
that you have a person they can talk to or a policy that you point them to? And
so,
then, yeah, we want to get into the structural issues.
Okay, so in both levels, just very concretely, we try to deal with this in several ways. And the first challenge is you have to look at data, because data is where you begin to identify the biases. So over the last couple of years, we have been trying to change both the way we collect data, but also how we report data, to begin to make clear where some of these problems sit and to help us all own responsibility for fixing them. So at the most basic level, and I think Ebony alluded to this, and certainly this is something that Tabitha Palmore, the head of the Rutland area and NAACP, has pointed out, that much of our African-American community is widely dispersed across the state, so that in many cases, disproportionality in disciplinary outcomes and disproportionality in academic achievement are invisible at the local level. But by reporting at different levels, we can make clear that even though it's not visible in school-level data, it is actually a systems-level problem, because people need to see it in order to be able to acknowledge that it's something we want to work on. So I think the first thing is trying to use data to make transparent where we do see gaps that suggest that there's disproportionality in discipline outcomes, but also disproportionality in achievement, that really should give us pause and ask us to think about whether we are providing the right kind of responsive instruction that enables all children to succeed and thrive.
And you just said that it's pretty clear from that data that we're not. So what are
right.
we doing wrong?
And I think there are a number of things. And to be clear, it's not just about race. And we do have some data that suggests that we have disproportionality in discipline for students of color. But some of the biggest disparities are actually for students who live in poverty and students with disabilities. So this, I think the broader issue is we all need to own and take responsibility for the challenge of asking, what are the implicit biases that we may have that may help, that when we're making decisions may systematically end up disadvantaging certain students relative to others in ways that adversely affect their outcomes. So I think that's the first big challenge. Then the second piece is to figure out how to work to change biases. So, for example, when a superintendent calls us and says, I'm having this trouble, what we can do, and we actually are currently doing with several systems, is talking about how they could use available the federal Title I and Title II dollars or some of the Medicaid dollars to support trainings for staff. And there are actually some really great partner agencies that do terrific work in this area. I know the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, run by Curtis Reed, has done some excellent work in the southern tier of the state that have really addressed issues of implicit bias and cultural competence in schools and helped them rethink practices both in schools but also in the recruitment process to try to improve outcomes and opportunities for kids. There's other organizations. I think the Partnership for Change up in the Burlington area has done some good work. Rutland area NAACP has been bringing together folks. We've worked with some of our partner agencies. I know the VSA brought in with the superintendents and the special educators brought in Lena Tenney to do a statewide training. She's someone from Ohio State who specializes in this.
And we're actually going to have Curtis Reed and Lena Tenney on the program later this
fabulous.
Hour.
Fabulous. Well, then I'll let them talk to their excellent work.
But these are all for schools that are saying, we acknowledge we have a problem and we want to fix it. From the data, what it looks like is that the state has a problem and not all schools are at the point where they're willing to recognize that problem. So, Ebony Neone was saying one of the things that we need is perhaps a statewide policy, not a district-by-district policy, that addresses systemic racism and disciplinary issues and how to deal with them. Is that something that the agency would like to develop?
Well, what the agency has focused on, and the problem with implicit bias is you can't fix what you can't see. And so for us, a lot of this is about helping us all understand what the biases are that may actually be inadvertently. The difference between bias and racism is it's harm without intent. And I think many of our educators may genuinely want to do the right thing, but they may not understand the ways in which certain practices actively disadvantage some kids. So part of it is helping us actually not just implement a policy that someone's mandated, but to make it work with integrity, we need to be able to engage in professional development, work with each other, learn from some of these trainers, and really figure out how to proactively, first of all, develop the behaviors that lead to success, but also to be able to recognize when maybe our own behavior, our own assumption might actually be disadvantaging someone that we're working with. So I think it's we can do a discipline policy. I am not naive enough to believe that's going to solve the problem. And so I'm not saying it isn't something that the legislature could take up. What I do think is that we still have a tremendous amount of work to do around professional development statewide. What we've been trying to do, you know, for example, the agency is now in the process of training our own staff in implicit bias so that we can be a better resource to members of the field when we interact with them. And likewise, trying to identify possible providers who, when school districts reach out to us and say, hey, I'm aware now as I look at my data that this is actually someplace where I don't seem to be doing what I should be doing, that they can proactively go out and get some support and help them work through some of these challenges in a way that really turns the needle for some of our children.
Let's go to Jason, yeah, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Jason. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for having this topic. It's really important. It's something that our newly unified school district has expressed an interest in exploring as we develop our new slate of policies, a policy that might address bias in our district. And I really appreciate the comments of Ebony Neone on this, that this is a statewide issue as well as the previous caller, Becca. And the call for some real leadership from the state on this point. And I certainly recognize the work that the Secretary has outlined that is ongoing. And I also recognize the challenges of individual districts really wanting to take this on, especially in an era where, you know, where we're under a lot of pressure to moderate our spending. You only have to look to the announcement today to understand that we're being asked to decrease our spending while we're also trying to take on substantial issues in the community.
So, Jason, are you saying you'd like to see more money specifically for this?
I'm saying that this needs to be something that, if we're going to tackle as a state, that this is addressed statewide, and that it's not assumed that, just as Secretary Holcomb has said, that this shouldn't be a district-by-district solution. And that's going to mean investing resources in training, investing resources in realigning curricula. You can go and look at the curricula in any of our school districts and see ample opportunities to address bias embedded in the curriculum itself.
Jason, I take your point, and let's get another one in here from Hannah in Montpelier. Hi, Hannah. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking our call. We wanted to share with you that we are at Union Elementary School in Montpelier, and we are starting some really exciting work for next year where we are going to have training for our teachers really on how to talk to kids about race and racism. We wanted to address these things that come up in a proactive and collaborative way. My colleague, Emily Wrigley, is a first grade teacher, and she gets a lot of questions from kids about skin color, why is mine different than yours, why do I look different? And a lot of teachers don't feel prepared to have those conversations. So we want to work together and train ourselves to sort of systematically evaluate our practice and come up with the skills to address those questions in a really positive way. So we're excited to do that, and we wanted to share that with you and your listeners.
Hannah, thanks for your call. I really appreciate that. And let's go to Dr. Mish Kabay in Barrie. Hi, Dr. Kabay. Nice to talk with you.
Hello. Hello, folks. Very quickly, I want to recommend to all of the teachers a resource from a group that I absolutely love, the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, that has done sterling work in describing racism, the effects of racism and fighting racism and discrimination of all kinds through the law courts. They have a website called tolerance.org. So it's www.tolerance.org with a wealth of material for teachers. I am looking at one in particular called Anti-Racism Activity, The Sneeches, that is for grades K to 2 or maybe 3 to 5. It uses a Dr. Seuss book. And the interesting aspect for me, because I use this technique in my work in security training for adults, is simulation, where children are assigned a green star at random. In other words, you know, you put them in a list and you go, you're green, you're not, you're green, you're not, you're green. The children, they talk about privileges in the classroom together. And then the children with the green stars on their foreheads or whatever are given the privileges, and the children without the green stars aren't. And this goes on for, say, 20 minutes. And then the children discuss how they feel. Now, as you well know, the children will feel emotional responses quite quickly, and it opens up the discussion about appearance, about discrimination, about the experience of being discriminated against, how people feel. And that's all. I just wanted you to know about this resource.
Mish, thanks. I take that, and we'll pop a link up at vpr.net on the Vermont Edition page. Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, as we wrap up with you before we move on to the rest of our conversation, Ebony Nioni was saying at the very beginning of this hour, ending racism in schools is not hard. We just need to take the steps to do it. Do you think that's true? And is it something that you think we could accomplish in Vermont?
Oh, I think we can accomplish it in Vermont. I think the challenge is that it's hard to fix what you can't see. And the first thing we need to do is help people identify the ways in which all of us, and again, this is a statewide problem. I would say it's actually a national problem. The ways in which we behave and how those behaviors may actually adverse impact some of the people around us. So, you know, I think the challenge we've given ourselves at the agency is in every policy we do to ask the question, what is the impact of this particular action on equity? Because if we aren't explicit in making that one of the decision points that we address, we're fairly confident we won't address it. And it just takes a very disciplined, sustained attention to this as a priority. And, you know, in a unique way, Vermont has an extraordinary opportunity to try to do this right, because, you know, certainly right now in the state, the fastest growing demographic group in our state is our children of color. We know that these families, particularly in the Chittenden County area, tend to be younger than our aging Vermont demographic. They are more likely to be involved in the workforce. They're contributing millions and millions of dollars to our Vermont economy. And we have an extraordinary opportunity to learn from what didn't work in other states to actually listen and learn, identify these biases and work together to try to fix them and really build this more perfect union we care about in Vermont.
That's Rebecca Holcomb, Secretary of the Agency of Education in Vermont. Secretary Holcomb, thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
All this hour, we're talking about how Vermont schools are dealing with issues of bias, race, inclusion, and diversity. We heard from Black Lives Matter Vermont founder Ebony Nioni and Agency of Education head Rebecca Holcomb. Peter in Moortown says, I think we need to change our hiring practices to seek out diverse candidates for openings that will help transform our faculties into mirrors of our increasingly diverse student populations. Much research has been written about how students of color have more success when they have educational mentors who look like them, and the increased interactions with adults of varying backgrounds will help all Vermont students and educators with the empathy process. Let's go to Bill calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Bill. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to connect with the decision recently in South Burlington to back off from the symbolism of rebel and choosing a different mascot. And I was part of the class that chose rebels back when really, the tradition of the town was building a proud tradition. And what we did was put out in front our awareness of what we didn't really anticipate needing to fix. And we put out in front awareness of issues of racism and diversity and inclusion. And that was the real thrust of choosing what was to be a mascot, but really it was choosing an identity for the high school. And I think all schools can put out in front community awareness of what we want to create as our tradition.
Yeah.
Building a proud tradition may be one.
Bill, yeah, I hear your point. Thank you for making it. And let's turn to two more people now for more perspective on this issue and perhaps for how schools can work on this and communities. We're going to talk with two people who are working within the school systems in Vermont to make change. Curtis Reed is Executive Director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity based in Brattleboro. Curtis, nice to talk with you again.
Glad to be here.
And Lena Tenney is a researcher and facilitator with the Kirwan Institute at Ohio State University. It's a leading national research institute on race, cognition, and implicit bias. Lena is one of the three Kirwan teachers and trainers who've worked with Vermont educators in the last year. Lena, welcome to Vermont Edition.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So Ebony Nioni kind of expressed what the problem is in Vermont and how Black Lives Matter Vermont thinks that we could address this at a statewide level. Secretary Rebecca Holcomb talked about issues of implicit bias that need to be addressed throughout the school system. How do we go about implementing change or instituting policies that can lead to better outcomes? Curtis Reed, I'll start with you.
Great. Well, where we start is the sort of the economic argument of why this work is really important. We have an aging population. We have the lowest birth rate in the nation. 20% of us, nearly 20% of us are 65 and older. And we have an outflux of young people, 18 to 34. Vermont's economic future is directly tied to its ability to attract and retain business from the multicultural marketplace, where ethnic racial minorities provide the tourists, provide the new crop of entrepreneurs and investment capital. So it's really important that our workforce, which is coming out of our schools, has the level of cultural humility to be able to engage a population, to engage a market with which we've had very little contact with in the past.
So how do you do that? How do you do that in a school system where, as you say, there's been very little need for that in the past? There are schools where there are very few students of color, if any. Mm-hmm. There are schools where teachers and administrators have had maybe a little bit or no cultural competency training. And there are some schools that say, look, this is something we really want to tackle. And then there are schools that are not saying that, that are not trying to advocate for resources or training. Mm-hmm. So how do you make sure that that's across the board so students can feel safe in whatever school system they come into?
Our stealth method for doing that is using Vermont State Police, because it takes at least a decade to have that sort of cultural shift. And Vermont State Police has begun that conversation and that cultural shift a little over a decade ago. So it's getting schools, school districts, individual schools to make a commitment to focus on bias, to focus on the sorts of curriculum and changes over a decade.
So you mean that the State Police is more the stealth model rather than your actual you're not putting state police in the schools to tell people they've got to work on this.
No, we're not. But what we have done, and I believe that's been reflected now in the Agency of Education, for the last 3, maybe 4 years now, at our annual Vermont Vision for Multicultural Future Conference, state police leadership and leadership in Agency of Education have had an opportunity to engage and to talk in them. I believe the example the state police has set has really charted a course for the Agency of Education in their recent efforts to train all their personnel around issues of implicit bias. It's one thing for, an activist to tell the secretary, you ought to do this, but it's very different when the commissioner for public safety and the colonel for state police say, we've been doing this. It's hard work. It really requires the expenditure of social, political, and financial capital to make it happen. But if you drop the pebble in the water now, you'll see results 5, 10 years down the line. But it really means being consistent.
So, Lena Tenney, I want to bring you into this conversation because you've been working with Vermont educators in the last year as well with the Kerwin Institute. When you start introducing people to the idea of cultural competency training, what's your starting point here in Vermont?
I think the biggest starting point is having buy-in that this is important. And our experience with Vermont educators has been that there is a lot of buy-in, that folks really want to do what's best for students, to treat students equitably, and to reduce those racial disparities that we see in things like school discipline. So that's the biggest issue, is getting people on board. Because in a society where a lot of folks are saying we're supposedly post-racial, we should stop talking about race, it's really important that we get folks to recognize, no, racism still exists. And we need to do something about it. So that commitment is the first piece that's most important for us. And then we can have the conversation about what implicit bias looks like, what structural racism looks like, and what we can do as individuals and institutions in order to combat those effects, and hopefully to actually get at the root of the problem and not just be mitigating individual incidents as they occur.
We got a note from Stephen who says, I'm a high school English teacher in the Northeast Kingdom, and for the past year I've been meeting with a small group of teachers, administrators, and parents to have conversations about addressing race and racism in our schools. We've discussed the need for more professional development to give teachers the tools to see their classrooms through a racial equity lens, whether in design of curriculum or considering classroom management. Next year, our work will be supported by an Honoring Diversity Grant from the Rowland Foundation, along with 9 other projects in schools across the state. The status quo upholds colorblindness as the right perspective for teachers to take. As we work to shift that through professional development, we're noticing that it is sometimes hard to balance the racial learning needs of our white students with the need to make our schools safe and supportive places for our students of color. Sometimes conversations about race can leave our students of color feeling targeted or more isolated, and I wonder if your guests have any thoughts about that. Lena Tenney?
Certainly. So research dating back to the 1950s indicates that having meaningful, equitable conversations with people across racial lines is actually a fairly effective way of mitigating bias and increasing understanding. So that intergroup contact can be really valuable, but it needs to be done in ways that are thoughtful and conscious of the experiences of everyone at the table. And so those kind of conversations, of course, can leave students of color feeling really isolated, feeling like they might be the only one, or feeling like they're being asked to educate other folks on their experience on top of having to navigate a society and sometimes a school system that already are creating issues for them. And so one thing to do is to make sure that folks are coming in on an equal playing field. Having power dynamics present is not helpful for intergroup contact, and to be really honest, one of those power dynamics can be simply race itself. So it's really important to make sure that students are involved in these conversations, in planning them from the beginning as well, asking students, what is it that would make this conversation something that you're willing to participate in and something that can be helpful as opposed to perhaps re-traumatizing? And one way that that can happen is by looking at the Kerwin Institute's Principles for Equitable and Inclusive Civic Engagement, work by my colleague Kip Hawley. That's available online for free, and it's a great tool for looking at how we can have these sorts of difficult, challenging conversations in a way that's meaningful and in a way that considers everyone who is at the table and how to get everyone at the table in the first place as well.
Curtis, how do you, jump in here. How do you address that? I mean, that question that Stephen's talking about is interesting, of how do you allow white students to ask questions without making students of color who may also be participants in that conversation feel targeted or unsafe or like this conversation is, it feels terrible to them in some cases.
Well, I want to make another comment relative to your last caller. To really applaud the work that they're doing. But the challenge is whether or not the school boards have bought into this idea of eliminating racism from the schools, because that takes resources. And whereas he has an outside grant, once that grant evaporates, is the school board prepared to continue funding an initiative that will produce sort of anti-racist within our schools? So, from a structural piece, it's really important that school boards buy into this overall venue of we're dedicating time and resources to implicit bias, to addressing racism, not on an episodic basis, but really in a systemic way.
And are they? Do you find school boards are on board with this?
I find school boards really struggle with it, because there are so many other competing interests that the issues of race are at the bottom of their priority list, except in the occasion when something, when there's an episode that happens, when there's a critical incident. So I really think that school boards need to support their superintendents, their principals, and their teachers But oftentimes what happens is leadership, teachers are trying to do the leading when in fact it should be the school board that does the leading.
You know, you can train people in schools, but you're not necessarily training families where bias is obviously also rooted. I mean, that's where it starts for so many of us. Really keep racism out of our schools if we're not addressing it in our communities?
Well, think about the ways in which, you know, parents teach their children. You know, I've been the object of a 3 or 4 year old saying, "Mommy, mommy, look at that chocolate man." And, you know, the parent in horror, recoils the child. And I say, no, this is an age appropriate observation. And, you know, so we sit down, we talk about chocolate as an important food group, from white chocolate to deep, dark chocolate, and that I'm not edible. But when you take the child out of that natural inquisitiveness, you're saying to the child, no, that's not a good thing for you to talk about. That's not something that we talk about publicly. And so what happens is that our children never learn the skills to engage the other, whomever the other might be, by virtue of the fact that parents are scared to engage in a conversation, in an honest and authentic conversation with their children about difference, whether it's around disability or around national origin or around race, religion, et cetera.
Lena, you are sort of an outsider in terms of, you know, not living in Vermont, but being able to come in and maybe have this perspective that we don't have from inside here. What did you observe about Vermont educators in your training? How are we doing?
That's a great question, Jane. So my observations are layered, and in the 2 times that I've been to Vermont to work with superintendents, special education directors, school board members, teachers, and actually students, I made a number of observations, one of which was that by and large, folks are hungry to do better, yet are feeling like they have not been equipped or empowered to do so. So there's been a high demand for building skill sets, for schools where folks can know how to do things like interrupt bias when it happens. So we've talked with educators about the bystander effect. How do you effectively intervene when bias is emerging in order to challenge and push back on those incidents in real time? Because most people have that sort of, oh, wow, did they really just say that moment that we're all familiar with, and some more than others in our lives. And a lot of people, particularly folks with dominant identities, are not sure what to say in response to that. So that's been one focus, is that when bias emerges, we need to have people be empowered to intervene, and not just the folks who are being targeted, because that's a double targeting to expect folks to be the only ones speaking up when they're experiencing bias. And another observation was that people really seem to be grappling with this idea of what does it mean to be in Vermont, to be in this particular setting where the population is predominantly white, and that's an understatement, and where there might be only a couple kids of color in the school system. So how can we be effective considering that context? And that's a multi-layered question that we can't get into right now, but that has been a particular concern, especially considering that can often burden those few children of color to be the spokesperson almost for their entire group, which is not fair to anyone, much less a child. We had students in our latest day-long workshop that broke out and had a session and talked about their experience and told one of our facilitators, "I feel like my peers and my teachers are afraid of me because I'm black."
Lena, you're giving us some great fodder for our next conversation on this topic, and I really appreciate it and want to thank you. Lena Tenney, researcher and facilitator with the Kirwan Institute at Ohio State University, has been training some Vermont teachers. Curtis Reed is executive director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, based in Brattleboro. Thanks to both of them for discussing race and racism in schools. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.